And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in the exciting gateway to the Old West in the most haunted city in the country. Well, my ultra-liberal wife has suggested that we do a GoFundMe page to replace Melania's underwear the FBI pawed through during their raid on Mar-a-Lago. There could have been nuclear secrets in the crotches of her underwear. FBI had to be thorough. Today's August 16th, 228th day of the year. 137 days remain to the end of the year. On this day in 1 BC, Wang Mang consolidates his powers, declared Marshal of State. Emperor Ai of Han, who had died the previous day, had no heirs. Wang Mang was the man. 942 AD. Started the 4-day battle of Al-Madain between the Hamdanids of Mosul and the Bandis of Basra over control of the Abbasid capital, Baghdad. 963, Nikephoros II Pokras is crowned emperor of the Byzantine Empire, which was the originally was the Eastern Roman Empire. 1328, the House of Gonzaga seizes power in the Duchy of Mantua. They're going to rule until 1708. 1328, the House of Gonzaga, 1513, Battle of the Spurs, also known as the Battle of Guinegate. Henry VIII of England and his imperial allies defeat French forces who were then forced to retreat. 1570, the Principality of Transylvania is established after John II Zápolya renounces his claim as King of Hungary in the Treaty of Speyer. 1652, Battle of Plymouth. It was an inconclusive naval action between the fleets of Michel de Ruyter and George Eskew in the First Anglo-Dutch War. 1777, American Revolutionary War. Americans led by General John Stark rout the British and Brunswick troops under Frederick Baum at the Battle of Bennington and Walloomsack in New York. 1780, American Revolutionary War, Battle of Camden. The British defeat the Americans near Camden, South Carolina. 1792, Maximilien de Robespierre presents the petition of the Commune of Paris to the Legislative Assembly, which demanded the formation of a revolutionary tribunal. Let's hang them all. 1793, French Revolution, a levy en masse is decreed by the National Convention. Now, for those who are not familiar with that phrase, it's a French term used for a policy of mass national conscription. It's often done in the face of invasion. The concept originated during the French Revolutionary Wars, particularly for the period following August 16, 1793, when able-bodied men aged 18 to 25 were conscripted. It formed an integral part of the creation of national identity, makes it distinct from forms of conscription which had existed before that time. Basically, if you got two legs and they work, you going in the army, son. War of 1812, American General William Hull surrenders Fort Detroit without a fight to the British Army. 1819, Peterloo Massacre, 17 people die and over 600 are injured in cavalry charges at a public meeting at St. Peter's Field in Manchester, England. 1841, President John Tyler vetoes a bill which called for the reestablishment of the Second Bank of the U.S. Enraged Whig Party members riot outside the White House in the most violent demonstration of White House grounds in U.S. history. I think they're overlooking the Liz Cheney is calling the coup of January 6th, but we'll see. 1858, President James Buchanan inaugurates the new transatlantic telegraph cable by exchanging greetings with Queen Victoria of the UK. However, a weak signal forces a shutdown of the service within a few weeks. 1859, the Grand Duchy of Tuscany formally deposes the exiled House of Lorraine. 1863, the Dominican Restoration War begins when Gregorio Luperón raises the Dominican flag in Santo Domingo after Spain recolonized the country. 1869, Battle of Acostanu. Paraguayan battalion made up of children is massacred by the Brazilian army during the Paraguayan War. 1870, Franco-Prussian War. The Battle of Mars La Tour is fought, resulting in a Prussian victory. 1891, the Basilica San Sebastian in Manila, the first all-steel church in Asia, is officially inaugurated and blessed. 1896, Sukum Jim Mason, George Carmack, and Dawson Charlie discover gold in a tributary of the Klondike River in Canada. This sets off the Klondike Gold Rush. 1900, the Battle of Elands River during the Second Boer War ends after a 13-day siege is lifted by the British. The battle began when a force of between 2,000 and 3,000 Boers had surrounded a force of 500 Australians, Rhodesians, Canadians, and British soldiers at a supply dump at Brakfontein Drift. 1906, an 8.2 Valparaiso earthquake hit central Chile, kills 3,882 people. 1913, Tohoku Imperial University, Japan, that's the modern day Tohoku University, becomes the first university in Japan to admit female students. 1913, completion of the Royal Navy battlecruiser HMS Queen Mary took place on this date. 1916, the Migratory Bird Treaty between Canada and the U.S. is signed. 1918, the Battle of Lake Baikal was fought between Czechoslovak Legion and the Red Army. 1920, Ray Chapman of the Cleveland Indians is hit on the head by a fastball thrown by Carl Mays of the New York Yankees. He dies early the next day. Chapman was the second player to die from injuries sustained in a Major League Baseball game. The first was Doc Powers in 1909. 1920, the Congress of the Communist Party of Bukhara opens up. Congress would call for armed revolution. Yeah, all y'all go fight. I'll sit here and pontificate. 1920, Polish-Soviet War. Battle of Rzeszów concludes. The Soviet Red Army is forced to turn away from Warsaw. 1923, the UK gives the name Ross Dependency to part of its claimed Antarctic territory and makes the Governor General of the Dominion of New Zealand its administrator. 1927, the Dole Air Race begins from Oakland, California to Honolulu, Hawaii, during which six out of the eight participating planes crash or disappear. That wasn't good. 1929, the 1929 Palestine riots break out in mandatory Palestine between Palestinian Arabs and Jews and continue to the end of the month. In total, 133 Jews and 116 Arabs are killed. 1930, the first color sound cartoon called Fiddlesticks is released by UB Iwerks. Also in 1930, the first British Empire Games are opened in Hamilton, Ontario by the Governor General of Canada, the Viscount Willingdon. 1933, Christie Pitts riots take place in Toronto, Ontario. 1942, World War II, a naval L-class blimp drifts in from the Pacific and crashes in Daly City, California. The two-man crew had vanished. Nobody has any idea what happened to them. 1944, first flight of a jet with the forward swept wings, the Junkers JU-287, took place on this date. 1945, the National Representatives Congress, the precursor of the current National Assembly of Vietnam, convenes in Sun Dorong. 1946, mass riots in Kolkata began. More than 4,000 people be killed in 72 hours. Also in 46, the All Hyderabad Trade Union Congress is founded in Secunderabad. 1954, the first issue of Sports Illustrated is published. They did not yet have a swimsuit issue. 1960, Cyprus gained its independence from the UK on this date. So in 1960, Joseph Kittinger parachutes from a balloon over New Mexico at 102,800 feet, setting three records it held until 2012. High altitude jump, longest free fall, and high speed by a human without an aircraft. And in 62, 8 years after the remaining French India territories are handed to India, the ratification of the treaties are exchanged to make the transfer official. In 1964, Vietnam War, coup d'etat replaces Dorong Van Minh with General Nguyen Khan as president of South Vietnam. A new constitution is established with aid from the U.S. Embassy. 1966, Vietnam War, the House Un-American Activities Committee begins investigations of Americans who evaded the Viet Cong. The committee intends to introduce legislation to make these activities illegal. Anti-war demonstrators disrupt the meeting and 50 people are arrested. No one was shot. 1972. In an unsuccessful coup d'etat attempt, the Royal Moroccan Air Force fires on Hussein II of Morocco's plane while he's traveling back to Rabat. 1975, Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam symbolically hands over land to the Gurindji people after the 8-year Wave Hill walk-off, a landmark event in the history of Indigenous land rights in Australia, commemorated in a 1991 song by Paul Kelly and an annual celebration. 1987, Northwest Airlines Flight 255 of McDonnell Douglas MD-82 crashes after takeoff in Detroit, killing 154 of the 155 on board, plus two people on the ground. I've said before and I'll say again, when an airplane falls on you, you're having a bad day. 1989, a solar particle event affects computers at the Toronto Stock Exchange, forcing a halt to trading. 1991, Indian Airlines Flight 257, a Boeing 737-200, crashes during approach to Imphal Airport, killing all 69 people on board. 2005, West Caribbean Airways Flight 708, a McDonnell Douglas MD-82, crashes at Machiques in Venezuela, killing all 160 people on board. 2008, the Trump International Hotel and Tower, Chicago, is topped off at 1,389 feet at the time, becoming the world's highest residence above ground level. 2010, Air's Flight 8250 crashes at Gustavo Rojas Pinilla International Airport in San Andres, Providencia, Colombia, killing two people. 2012, South African police fatally shoot 34 miners and 178 more during an industrial dispute at Americana near Rustenburg. 2013, the ferry St. Thomas Aquinas collides with a cargo ship and sinks at Cebu, Philippines, killing 61 people and 59 others are missing. 2015, more than 96 people were killed and hundreds injured following a series of air raids by the Syrian Arab Air Force on the Rebel Harrah market town of Douma. Also in 2015, Trigana Air Flight 267 and ATR 42 crashes in Oxibo, Bagungan, Bintang, killing all 54 people on board. 2017, the Minamata Convention on Mercury enters into force. 2020, the August Complex fire in California burns more than 1 million acres of land. California's had a interesting series of fires. But remember what the great Smokey Bear said, only you can prevent forest fires. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history, holidays and observances, Bennington Battle Day in Vermont, Children's Day in Paraguay, Christian Feast Day, Ana Petra Perez Florido, Armel, Diomedes of Tarsus, Roch, Stephen I of Hungary, translation of the Heteropolodos icon from Edessa to Constantinople in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Gozan no Okurbi in Kyoto, Japan. National Airborne Day in the U.S. Restoration Day in the Dominican Republic. First day of the Independence Day. Celebrate independence of Gabon from France in 1960. And it's Che Colatada in France. Alrighty, let's see what else we have. Okay, in 1384, Hongwu, Emperor of Ming China, Emperor Dong, hears cases of a couple who Tory money bills were fighting over them. Now, under the law, that's equal to an act of destroying stamped government documents. And according to law, there had to be 100 floggings. Hangul Emperor Dong decided to pardon them. Did not give them the money back. 1501, Michelangelo awarded a contract to create a statue of David at Florence Cathedral by the overseers of the Office of the Works of the Duomo. 1513, Battle of the Spurs that I mentioned earlier. Henry VIII of England, the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian I joined up to beat France. 1570, King of Hungary John Sigismund Zápolya signs a secret treaty with Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian II. 1625, Ernest Casimir of Nassau-Dietz appointed Viceroy of Dorinth. 1691, Yorktown, Virginia is founded. 1717, Prince Eugenius of Savoy occupies Belgrade. 1743, the Champion of England title holder, Jack Bruton, publishes Rules of the Ring, the first boxing code. My goodness. Sorry about that. 1748, the Gelder Melson sails to the East Indies. 1787, Turkey declares war on Russia. It was known as the Russo-Turkish War of 1787 to 1792. 1794, Hungarian revolutionary Ignác Martinović arrested in Vienna. 1797, Comet C, 1797 P1. Bouvard Herschel approaches to 0.0879 astronomical units of the Earth. 1812, I talked about General Hall surrendering Detroit and Michigan territory to British forces under the command of Major General Sir Isaac Brock. He captured the fort with the help of indigenous warriors led by Tecumseh, a Native American leader of the Shawnee. 1829, Siamese twins Chang and Ing Bunker arrive in Boston to be exhibited. 1861, President Lincoln prohibits Union states from trading with the Confederacy. Slight oversight on everybody's part. 1861, skirmishes at Fredericktown and Kirkville in Missouri. 1863, the Chickamauga campaign of the Civil War begins in Georgia. 1864, federal assault on the fourth day of Deep Bottom Run, the Battle of Deep Bottom Run in Virginia. 1864, the Palace for People's Industry officially opens in Amsterdam. 1865, Restoration Day in the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic regained its independence after 4 years of fighting against the Spanish annexation. 1870, Fred Goldsmith demonstrates that a curveball isn't an optical illusion. 1882, the British under General Wolseley land in Alexandria. 1890, Alexander Clark, journalist and lawyer, named minister to Liberia. 1891, President Harrison attends the dedication of the Bennington Battle Monument in Bennington, Vermont. 1894, chiefs from the Sioux and the Onondaga tribes meet to urge their people to renounce Christianity and return to their old Indian faith. 1898, Edwin Prescott patents the roller coaster. This day in 1904, New York City begins building Grand Central Station. In 1905, the Mbunga Rebellion occupies the German post Ifakara in East Africa. 1907, Moulay Hafid is proclaimed the Sultan of Morocco by supporters, which leads to a civil war. Moulay, supported by Germany, France, supports the existing Sultan. 1908, the Committee of Union and Progress, also known as the Young Turks, announced a program for reforms and respect for the rights of all within the Ottoman Empire, regardless of race or religion. The leader at that time was Enver Pasha. 1914, the German army occupies the last fort at Liege. The Belgian general Lehmann is caught. 1914, Zapata and Pancho Villa overrun Mexico. Also in 14, World War I, the Battle of Sur begins. 1918, U.S. troops overrun at Archangelsk by Bolshevik troops. 1934, the U.S. ends its occupation of Haiti. We've been there since 1915. Also in 34, U.S. explorer William Beebe descends 3,028 feet in the bathysphere in the ocean, don't you know? 1940, 45 German aircraft shot down over England on this date. 1940, pioneering Blood for Britain program started on this date, sending blood plasma for World War II wounded from the U.S., headed by Charles Drew. It officially began in Britain. 1943, the first long-time bombs on the Italian mainland came from Sicily. 1944, the Dutch begins diplomatic contact with the Vatican in London. 1945, Puyi, the last Chinese emperor and the ruler of Manchukuo, is captured by Soviet troops. He had been the emperor from about the age of five until the empire was dissolved. And then the Japanese captured him and put him in as the puppet ruler of Manchukuo. 1946, Direct Action Day. Widespread riots erupt in Calcutta between Muslims and Hindus over whether Pakistan should be a separate state. Over 4,000 are killed, 100,000 are left homeless. 1948, the Arabs blow up Latrun pumping station in Jerusalem. Also in 48, the Israeli pound becomes legal tender. 1953, on this date, the Shah of Persia, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, and Princess Soraya flee to Baghdad and into Rome. He was the last Shah of Iran. It was thanks to the waffling on the part of our government that the current government came to power. 1954, 200 pilgrims drown in Farazad, Iran, rainstorm flood. 1955, Fiat Motors orders the first private atomic reactor. 56, Adlai Stevenson nominated as U.S. Democratic presidential candidate. We know how that went. 1960, Britain grants independence to the Crown Colony of Cyprus. 1960, the Republic of the Congo, Zaire, and the Democratic Republic of Congo forms. 1961, 250,000 West Berliners demonstrated against the division of East Berlin. Okay. On this day in 1969, you saw the second day of the Woodstock Festival in Bethel, New York. Performers included Santana, John Sebastian, Mountain, Grateful Dead, Creedence Colorado Revival, Janis Joplin, Sly and the Family Stone, The Who, and Jefferson Airplane. And half the people there were higher than kites. Okay. Morocco King Hussein's the second B-727 shot during failed coup attempt by General Mohamed Oufkir. Reportedly, King Hussein grabbed the radio and told the rebel pilot stop firing, the tyrant's dead. Fooled the pilots to break off the attack. In 1974, the Ramones concert debut. Is there anything else worth? The interestingly enough, I saw something yesterday. It's called NASA's Unexplained Files. A lot of bizarre things happen in space that are classified. The first Chinese astronaut while in orbit heard somebody knocking on the door. And when he checked with other astronauts who followed him later, they all heard the same thing. Is there somebody out there? Well, you know, there are many, many, many stories that will just boggle your mind if you heard them. Now, of course, we've been talking about some of the murders that took place as part of the cleanup of the Kennedy assassination. Another murder was Maurice Gatlin, an attorney, legal counsel to the Minutemen, and one of Guy Bannister's associates. He supposedly had a heart attack and fell from a six-story balcony. Of course, but almost before he hit the ground, it was announced as natural causes. While attending a meeting of the Inter-American Bar Association in San Juan, Puerto Rico, he suffered a heart attack and fell over the ledge of a six-floor balcony. Now, nobody is sure exactly how that happened. He was another key witness sought by the investigation of District Attorney Jim Garrison. Now, he was a well-connected attorney, a fervent anti-communist in league with private investigator Guy Bannister and many others strongly associated with the anti-Castro efforts. When you delve into the investigation run by Garrison, there was a whole lot of activity behind the scenes that led up, apparently, to the assassination. Now, Gatlin was the legal counsel for the Minutemen. That was an extremely conservative group that was being investigated by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. It was suspected of being linked to the Kennedy assassination. And another item of interest, in addition to his association with Guy Bannister, Gatlin was also linked to others who had been mentioned as playing roles in the murder of Kennedy. He was involved in the covert dealings of a longtime CIA agent, Howard Hunt, and mafia boss Carlos Marcello. Now, Hunt, had extensive connections to organized crime. Especially the National Syndicate said to have been run by Seymour Weiss of the Standard Fruit Company. They sponsored the Guatemalan coup and the mafia kingpin Carlos Marcello. 1958, Hunt organized an anti-communist conference in Guatemala. Conference chairman was Antonio Valadares, Marcello's attorney in New Orleans. Also present at the meeting was Maurice Gatlin, whose office was at 544 Camp Street, like everybody else involved in New Orleans activity. That was Gatlin who served as bagman for Bannister, Clay Shaw, and the CIA when the transporter carried a suitcase full of $100,000 in cash to Paris for the OAS. That money was used by the organization to assassinate Charles de Gaulle in one of the many attempts the right-wing group of former French Army and Foreign Legion officers made against the French president's life. Jerry Brooks, a former Minuteman who worked for Bannister, said that Maurice Gatlin often bragged about his dual life. He once said, "I have pretty good connections. Stick with me and I'll give you a license to kill." He said later he'd seen Gatlin's passport and it was filled with stamps of airports all over the world. Gatlin, due to his movements as a transporter for the CIA and his intimate knowledge of the goings-on at 544 Camp Street, clearly became a liability. In May of 1964, before he could be located by the Warren Commission, he was pushed or jumped from the sixth floor of the El Panama Hotel in Panama City. When you look at it in perspective, a statement by former FBI agent William Turner seems appropriate. But the untimely deaths of Bannister, Warden, Gatlin gave me pause that there might in fact have been systematic elimination of people who knew too much. And clearly, you cannot dispute that. When I published a book I'm working on that includes the contents of the tape I was sent, it becomes very clear there was a well-organized cleanup underway to eliminate anyone who could name names about the Kennedy assassination. Now, there's been much discussion about the rooming house where Oswald lived in Dallas. His landlady was named Earlene Roberts. She allegedly died of a heart attack. Almost before her body hit the floor, it was pronounced natural causes. Well, she was so harassed by the authorities, her relatives believed her health was ruined by the harassment. So even if her heart attack was in fact natural causes, you might say it was still caused by her relationship with Oswald. Now, she was a nurse, but when she became diabetic, she gave up her nursing career and began renting out rooms at her home in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. She was said to be an intelligent and confident woman. Everyone believed she'd be a very good witness. October 14, 1963, she rented one of the rooms in her home to Lee Harvey Oswald, but it was under a different name. He went by the name of O.H. Lee in this particular instance. Now, Earlene Roberts was an important witness, and the authorities weren't happy about what she had to say. She testified that a friend called her about 1 p.m. and informed her of the assassination of President Kennedy. She immediately turned on her TV set in the downstairs room, and Oswald came through the door and rushed by her, going to his room in quite a hurry. Now, she was sure she saw and heard a police car stop and honk outside Oswald's room right after the assassination. She was a confident witness whose testimony reveals what certainly was certainly exactly what she saw. And she was asked, did a police car pass the house and honk? She said, yes. When was that? He came in the house. When he came in the house, yes. When he came in the house and went to his room, the police car stopped right in front of the house and honked its horn. She said, I'd worked for some policemen, and sometimes they come by and tell me something that made their wives want me to know, and I thought it was them, and I glanced out the window and saw the number, and I said, that's not their car, because I knew their car. And she was asking, do you mean it wasn't the car of the policeman you knew? And she said, it wasn't the police car I knew, because their number was 170, and it wasn't car 170, so I ignored it. Then she was asked who was in the car. She said, I don't know. I didn't pay any attention after I noticed it wasn't them. Where was it parked? It was parked right square in front of the house. She went on to testify the number she saw on the police car was 106. And shortly after the police car honked, Oswald left the house. And that brought up a serious question or problem for the authorities to explain, because the Dallas Police Department denied they had any cars in that area anywhere near 1 p.m. on November 22, 1963. And her testimony also posed further problems for the powers that be, because the time frame in which she placed Oswald leaving her home made it difficult for him to have been at the scene of the murder of Tippett a few minutes later. She said she saw Oswald waiting at the bus stop outside after he left her house. A couple of minutes after that, Officer Tippett was shot dead and Oswald was accused of that crime. But the Tippett crime scene was over a mile away, and it was established no buses had come by during that time frame in the direction of Officer Tippett's slaying. So, what did the powers that be do as a result of these disparities between her testimony and the official version of events? Well, after testifying in Dallas in April of 64, she was subjected to intensive police harassment. They visited her at all hours of the day and night, contacted her employers, and identified her as the Oswald Rooming House Lady. As a result, she was dismissed from three housekeeping and nursing jobs in April, May, and June of 64 alone. So it's probably fair to say she was driven to her death by all the harassment. Relatives report that right up until her death, a year and a half later, she complained of being worried to death by the police. She said every time I'd walk out on the front porch, somebody was standing there with a camera. Well, you can draw some conclusions from this particular case. The case very clearly relates to the JFK assassination. It was yet another very obvious case of the powers that be intimidating and harassing key witnesses because their testimony didn't fit the official version of events. As far as her death, it appears to have actually been a heart attack, so it's virtually impossible to determine the cause. But her relatives noted her deteriorating health as a direct result of the harassment from which she suffered. Now, there was no doubt in anybody's mind that she was singled out for this harassment because she wouldn't play ball. And that, of course, is a scenario that runs all through many of the witness deaths. For example, let's talk about Al Guy Bogard. He died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Official verdict? He committed suicide. So he witnessed Oswald being someplace the real Oswald couldn't have been. He was subjected to harassment, but appears to have been depressed and taken his own life. Now, he was the car salesman who witnessed Lee Harvey Oswald, or an Oswald impersonator, test drive a car at high speeds. Now, this was a significant point because the real Oswald couldn't drive. It seemed like a setup to establish something about Oswald's history, referred to in intelligence parlance as creating a legend, because the person who made a specific point of talking about Russian and telling Bogard no uncertain terms he couldn't afford the car at the moment, but was expected to come into a large sum of money in the very near future. He also specifically made the comment loud enough for others to hear and recall that maybe he would have to go back to Russia to get a car. When Bogard remembered writing the name down on a business card, he wrote Lee Oswald. And when he heard of Oswald's name on TV as a subject of the assassination, he was sure it was the same Oswald, and he tossed the card in the garbage. FBI heard about that and became interested. You know, when they don't spend their time going through women's underwear drawer, they can be rather effective. You know, the real Bogard question is, why did the FBI go through a trash dumpster to find a Bogard business card in which he wrote the name Lee Oswald? Now, if Oswald had perhaps written it, maybe it would matter. It just makes no sense, except the FBI left no garbage dumpster unchecked. And I'm sure they checked the dumpsters at Mar-a-Lago as well. Well, perhaps we figured out why the FBI was so interested in that business card with Oswald's name on it. Very clearly established the real Oswald was somewhere else on that day and at that time. But the card was actual physical proof that somebody impersonating Oswald was at the downtown Lincoln Mercury dealership at the same time. Historian Walt Brown had a plausible explanation for what actually transpired. He said Oswald, the one married to Marina and friend of Ruth Payne, was clearly alibied for the afternoon of November 9th, again raising the issue of an imposter. The business card that Bogard wrote the name Lee Oswald on was the hard evidence of the imposter. And that's why Lawrence called it in. Also explains why FBI agents combed through the dumpsters in search of that card. It was what they called hard evidence. Without that card, as we know from other instances where real evidence was flim-flammed or people saw things that were wrong, could easily have been stated that Bogard was wrong. It actually waited on a customer named maybe Lou Osborne, and in the confusion and tragedy of the moment, he mistook Lee Oswald for Lon Osborne, who amazingly bore a striking resemblance to Lee Oswald. Well, the card would be proof that he knew the name of the person he talked to. Well, they didn't find the cards, or so they would have everybody believe, and Bogard was subjected to Nisenko-like interviews, including one in the cells of the Dallas jail prior to him committing suicide, allegedly, in February 1966. Now, the mention of Nisenko was in reference to a brutal interrogation of a Russian spy suspected of being a double agent. There's some obfuscation and elimination of unwanted evidence that Walt Brown titled his book, The War on Omission, referencing that. After the Kennedy assassination, when the case obviously should have been investigated to determine what witnesses actually saw, instead those interviews were obviously structured to avoid certain facts and are noteworthy for what they did not cover. They were clearly orchestrated interviews conducted by the FBI. And interestingly enough, in all the interviews they conducted, they did not ask anybody where they thought the shots came from. Attempts by authorities to marginalize certain individuals should also be suspicious in their own right. For example, the FBI clearly attempted to marginalize the testimony of Arnold Rowland, who told him that with certainty he saw a man on the sixth floor window of the school book depository who could not identify as Oswald. What Rowland didn't see was an identifiable Lee Oswald with a gun. Because he didn't see that which had to be seen. The FBI sent a bevy of agents scurrying to interview anyone who could state for the record that Rowland had a nasty habit of lying or making things up for the sake of getting attention. And if Rowland had wanted attention, he would have made himself instantly famous by simply telling the FBI what they wanted to hear. That it was possible that it could have been Oswald who he saw with the rifle. Well, he's to be credited that he didn't because he knew it wasn't the truth. There are no other instances I can find where the investigating agency, in this case the FBI, investigating a state crime, went to the trouble of checking out the honesty quotient of any other witness. Just the one who saw something he shouldn't have seen. Now, keep in mind, at the time Kennedy was assassinated, killing the president was not a federal crime. It was a state crime. And there were no state lines involved, so what was the jurisdiction of the FBI to be involved? Now, Bogard was maligned in much the same manner, although rougher, more blatant. He wasn't asked to describe the man he saw because he positively identified him. He wasn't taken to a lineup, and subsequent to this, he was given a lie detector test. Also beaten severely by individuals unknown and re-interviewed by the FBI several times, including an interview held in the Dallas Police Department jail cells on the date of September 17, 1964, when the Warren Report was being printed already. It wasn't clear what actually drove Bogard to commit suicide. It is clear he was bullied by the FBI, and that, as he put it himself, people are out there to get him. They searched high and they searched low, like an episode of CSI, to find that business card and never could. Instead, they found Bogard by the side of the road, dead as a hammer. His first cousin, Jimmy Harper, found the body, although he didn't provide information indicating death by something other than suicide, he did say that Bogard knew people out to get him and may have taken his own life for that reason. Let's talk about Lee Bowers. He suffered wounds in an automobile crash that led to his death. Official verdict? Of course, accidental. An eyewitness reported that Bowers' car was driven off the road by another car. Now, he didn't die immediately and is said to have reported to emergency personnel he believed he'd been drugged during his stop for coffee shortly before the crash. A lot of folks, and I do this myself sometimes, will stop at truck stops or diners and get a cup of coffee to stay awake. Now, he was an important witness. He was in a unique vantage point during the assassination and clearly reported seeing things that contrasted with the official version of events. His testimony is as explosive as any recorded by the Warren Commission. He was one of 65 known witnesses to the assassination who thought the shots were fired from the grassy knoll. The knoll is west of the Texas School Book Depository. He was also in a unique position to observe some pretty strange behavior in the knoll area during and immediately before the assassination. At that point in time, he was a tower man with the Union Terminal Company, stationed in his 14-foot tower directly behind the grassy knoll. As he faced the assassination site, he could see the railroad overpass to his right front. In front of him was a parking lot, and then a wooden stockade fence and a row of trees running along the top of the grassy knoll. The knoll sloped down to the spot on Elm Street while Kennedy was killed. Police had cut off traffic into the parking area, Bauer said, so anyone moving about could actually be observed. Well, he observed from that unique vantage point, which was facing down on the now infamous grassy knoll, and what he reported has fascinated JFK researchers for decades. He made two significant observations which he revealed to the commission. First, he saw three unfamiliar cars slowly cruising around the parking area in the 35 minutes before the assassination. First two left after a few minutes. The driver of the second car appeared to be talking into a microphone or a telephone. He was holding something up to his mouth with one hand, driving with the other. Third car, with out-of-state plates and mud up to the windows, probed all around the parking area. He last remembered seeing it about 8 minutes before the shooting, pausing just above the assassination site. And he gave detailed descriptions of the cars and their drivers to law enforcement. He also observed two unfamiliar men standing on top of the knoll at the edge of the parking lot within 10 or 15 feet of each other. One man, middle-aged or slightly older, fairly heavy-set in a white shirt, dark trousers. Another younger man, about mid-20s, with a plaid shirt, plaid coat, or jacket. Both were facing toward Elm and Houston, where the motorcade had come from. And they were the only strangers he remembered seeing. On August 9, 1966, Lee Bowers was killed when his car left the road and crashed into a concrete abutment in Midlothian, Texas. He was heading west on Highway 67 from Midlothian down to Claiborne. According to an eyewitness, he was driven off the road by a black car, sending him into a bridge abutment. Unfortunately for the powers that be, he didn't die immediately. Held on for 4 hours, and during that time was talking to the ambulance people and told him he felt he'd been drugged. According to the author Penn Jones, Bowers began receiving death threats about testifying to the Warren Commission about what he'd seen, giving further evidence to attorney Mark Lane, who wrote the book Rush to Judgment. Bowers' widow at first insisted to Penn Jones that there was nothing suspicious about her husband's death. And then finally she became flustered and said, well, they told him not to talk. David Welsh, another researcher, reported that the attending physician who accompanied Bowers in the ambulance noticed something peculiar about the victim. Said he was in a strange state of shock, a different kind of shock than an accident victim experiences. I can't explain, never seen anything like it. There was no autopsy, in spite of Texas law, and apparently the body was cremated almost immediately after death. Doctors saw no evidence he had suffered a heart attack. Well, there was an obvious question that Geraldo Rivera asked. Why would Lee Bowers have been killed when it seemed he'd already told all he knew? Well, there was a good answer for that. The documentary stated that Bowers confided in his minister he had seen a lot more than he told publicly. Friend of Bowers, Walter Rischel, told reporters Bowers had been afraid to tell all that he actually witnessed during the Kennedy assassination. Rischel said that Bowers confided in him with information that was much more specific about the assassination and he was afraid to go public with for very good reasons. He said Bowers disappeared for about 2 days. And one night, I know for sure, which was very uncharacteristic of him. When he came back, one of his fingers was missing on one of his hands, so he gave Monty, his brother, some excuse about what happened, which Monty didn't accept, so he called the local hospitals and the clinics and some doctor's offices, and no record of anybody, especially not Lee Bowers, going in and having that taken care of. And it was shortly after that he was killed in that mysterious automobile accident. Now, author Gerald Posner and researcher David Perry have attempted to preclude the tale of Bowers' death as nothing more than sensationalism. As Posner put it, it was conclusively proved that Bowers' death was accidental. Posner was apparently referring to the article by David Perry, Now It Can Be Told, the Lee Bowers story. Posner and Perry are primarily referring to the criticism of the investigatory work in a Geraldo Rivera documentary that investigates the death of Lee Bowers and certain claims that were aired on the program. Some of the criticisms of that program are valid. Others were not. Actually, an excellent brief documentary that you can watch online. On YouTube, of all places. There are contradictory claims concerning certain events related to the death, which it seemed irreconcilable. It's difficult, if not impossible, to now verify them either way with a certain degree of sufficient degree of certainty. And that's not all that unusual regarding a now relatively obscure event that occurred several decades ago. It is true and noteworthy that some of the claims surrounding the death are unsubstantiated and vague, but the fact that the truth apparently lies somewhere in the middle doesn't preclude Mr. Posner from stating Mr. Perry conclusively proved that Bowers' death was accidental. Unfortunately for Mr. Perry and Mr. Posner, that statement is not true. Former member of the Texas Highway Patrol, Charles Good, concluded that another car had indeed forced Bowers off the road. He testified eyewitness testimony confirmed that. Perry acknowledged that his investigation revealed that Charles Good was indeed a former member of the Texas Highway Patrol who claims to have investigated the accident. Apparently, he tried to minimize the investigatory skills of Mr. Good. And did conclude a car ran his friend Lee Bowers off the road, but Mr. Perry couldn't dismiss the results of Charles Good's investigation, so he attempts to minimize them, stating it's possible Bowers had been driving the car in the rear, and if the driver wasn't looking in the rearview mirror, he wouldn't know the accident occurred. In fairness, there's a concluding paragraph of that it is interesting. In the end, Monty Bowers, brother of Lee Bowers, concludes Lee's allergies contributed to his death. Both Monty and Lee had severe allergies and were prone to fits of sneezing. Took antihistamines that provided little relief. Well, I think that was more an attempt to rationalize something that couldn't be rationalized. Then we have another one of Jack Ruby's strippers, Marilyn Delilah Wally. Delilah was her stage name, and Miranda's as Marilyn Moon and Marilyn Magar and April Wally. She was an exotic dancer who was a regular performer at Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. She was killed by multiple gunshots. Now, the fact that it was multiple shots kept the authorities from immediately labeling it a suicide or an accidental death. They had to say it was murder. And of course, when someone is murdered who is married, the spouse is the automatic witness suspect. Now, as a dancer at Ruby's Club, it was known that she witnessed Oswald's presence there on numerous occasions, as well as the fact as apparent that Oswald and Ruby knew each other. A number of people confirmed that, even though the Warren Commission tried to ignore it. But her murder appears to be a domestic dispute unrelated to the Kennedy assassination, though, quite frankly, with all the nation going on, you really don't know for sure. Now, the next one that we don't have enough time to do justice to is the murder of Mary Pinchot Meyer. It's been observed that for a local Washington murder, a lot of men in suits and trench coats were certainly on the scene of her murder very quickly. Photographer at the crime scene made an observation the police kept us on the other side of the canal for a long time. I took the picture with a long-angle lens, and when I look at it now, I wonder who all those men in the picture were. She was killed by two gunshots from a .38 at point-blank range. First one to the back of the head, second straight through the heart. She was murdered indiscriminately, according to the official verdict, went out for her morning run. They decided it had to be a sex crime. She was the wife of a high-level CIA officer who had a serious affair with President Kennedy. Though the would-be investigation of Kennedy's assassination was a total whitewash and used her own high-level connections to research who really did kill Kennedy, her death caused a frantic search for her diary by the CIA's counterintelligence chief. There's quite a number of inconsistencies with the official version, and we'll talk about those tomorrow. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.